Hello and welcome to another installment, our second, of Odyssey Soundtrack Spotlight. I'm joined today by Doug Fake of Entrada as we discuss their latest release of a Jerry Goldsmith score, The Last Castle. Doug, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, I remember when I first heard about The Last Castle, it was back in 2001 from a Doug's Corner article you wrote. It was really fascinating. And you clearly loved the score back then, even though it wasn't coming out, you know, on your own label. You were writing a long article championing it about how much you loved the brass writing and all that kind of stuff. So why don't you just talk briefly about your relationship to this score and why it's such an important Goldsmith score for you?
Probably the biggest reason is because it's a military score, something that Jerry always excelled at. And it's also something that I particularly like because I grew up in the military. In the Air Force, in fact. I'm also a trumpet player, and all of those ingredients played a role in this score. And I made a friendship with the soloist, Malcolm McNabb. So somehow I got really, really big on this particular score.
Well, it's a showcase for Malcolm McNabb's art as a performer. I mean, the trumpet playing in this is just so smooth and beautiful all the way through. It's really remarkable.
Jerry had called me when he was working on the picture. This was in that period where we had a lot of conversations because we had worked a fair amount together and we hit it off pretty well, which Jerry didn't always do with, you know, people, but we did quite well. He actually called me on when he took on the project and he talked about it, what he was planning on doing. So I kind of paid attention to it for that reason. And the trumpet playing, of course, is exceptional. And it's a real smooth style playing. It's not a particularly technically challenging part to play, but to play it smooth and polished without making mistakes is difficult. And Malcolm did that perfectly.
In a lot of ways, this score is a showcase for the trumpet soloist, like it's a featured instrument. Along the lines of previous scores Jerry had done, like Lonely or the Brave and the Rambo trilogy. Actually, this for me plays a lot like a sequel to Rambo 3 because the main theme bears an extremely strong resemblance to the new theme Jerry wrote for that Rambo score.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's almost like him, James Horner-like, doing further refinements on an idea from a past project that, you know, maybe he wanted to play with a little bit more and change a little bit, tweak a little bit for, you know, a new context. I gather that he respected the film for The Last Castle a lot more than he did with Rambo 3. So maybe it was also a little bit like he didn't want that melodic idea to go to waste or something.
Yeah, you know, he didn't mention anything about that at the time that he was taken on the project. And I don't know if Mr. Lurie, the director, I don't know if that was a conscious decision on his part, because they did talk a lot about the approach he wanted on the score. Jerry had mentioned that he was going to do a lot of trumpet. I think the way he put it to Minifone is, you'll like this, Doug, there's going to be a lot of trumpet work. And he was kind of right. In fact, Malcolm was really, really proud of having gotten a chance to have a score which he knows was written with him in mind, as opposed to a score with a lot of trumpet, and he would happen to be the, you know, first chair player. In this case, he knew they had conversations. He knew he was going to be sort of the voice of this score. Of course, the 9/11 aspect, which we can talk about, you know, later, but that played all into this. And then Malcolm had, he actually did an interview with me, of all people. He came to my house and taped a brief interview. Didn't have so much to do with film scoring or this score as much as it had to do with my being a trumpet player, not in his league, but being a trumpet player. And also having to run a soundtrack label and produce soundtracks. So our paths crossed a number of times without it necessarily being a conscious decision on either of our parts. Therefore, he wanted to do an interview, talk about some of the scores that he played on, how familiar I was with them, just that kind of stuff. And it culminated on this project because I had told him, Jerry had made a point of saying, and this is a quote, "Oh, that Malcolm. He's so damn reliable." And Malcolm really liked hearing that. And since Jerry was telling me that quote, and I passed it on to Malcolm, he actually wanted to tape me saying that to put it, I don't know, to have sort of a recorded document that Jerry really, really appreciated his playing and had him in mind literally for this score. So there was a little bit of a relationship between I and Malcolm McNabb and this whole military part of it. And most of that, of course, developed after this picture.
This score has been greatly expanded by you, and probably a lot of people didn't realize how much music was left off the original release, which was, you know, just a little over a half hour of score. Now we've got probably 21 more minutes of score that's in the film, and then you're also including a large library of alternate cues that are interesting and significant. So let's maybe talk about those a little bit, because a lot of people may already have this album, but explain what they need to have on the expanded that they don't have on the previous album.
There's a couple cues that are, you could call them more or less incidental, like Rain and My Turn and the Cell Block.
See, I still like those because they kind of flesh out the development a little bit. But I mean, I guess it's fair to say they're not like the highlights of the score or anything.
In this kind of music, I mean, this is actually a very thoughtful score. It's always helpful to have the composer not only presenting his theme and then certain highlights, but sometimes his theme and then various ideas that are maybe drawn from the theme or from a harmonic statement or even some small motif. But you're hearing Jerry's mind at work, how he's drawing out the material, because it's all in his mind important to the overall, you know, score and the effect it has in the picture. I would probably say there's a cue called My Mission. I mean, it's brief, but it's kind of a highlight because it's kind of a climactic major key moment. Most of the score is obviously a minor key, and it has a very major key, almost Star Trek fanfare type of sound to it. It's just for a prison scene, but there's a degree of triumph in the scene. It was always, I considered it a fairly important cue. And then Jerry wrote that cue and then went back and I don't want to say he simplified the fanfare, but he took a da-da-dun, da-da-dun rhythm out of the brass and just turned it into a da-da, da-da rhythm and brass. Now, I can't say why, the way his mind works, it was just what he preferred. So present both versions of that, of course, on the album. So both versions are being heard for the first time on an album, and one for the first time ever.
It's a fairly significant cue. It's almost 2 minutes long. And I mean, as you say, it is a bit of a different mood from a lot of the other cues, which are more minor key and kind of downbeat. It is a very downbeat score, and I guess I would describe it as introspective. It's kind of like about internal workings of the characters and such rather than surface action. I mean, that's kind of carrying on in the Rambo tradition in some ways. Like, he's got strong action cues, but the heart of the score is that solo trumpet, especially most of the time, but it's connecting with the character's, you know, internal dignity and that kind of thing.
This has been discussed before, so this won't be new, but Jerry was drawn to the concept of fallen heroes and attaching a trumpet solo to fallen heroes. So rather than the bugle call approach, you know, to a warrior, which I'm sure he visited on occasion, but he was drawn to the concept. And I think it probably does go back to Jack Burns, because, you know, in Lonely of the Brave, Jack Burns' character is a flawed, you know, he doesn't even fit into the time period he's at. And initially we're introduced to him. He's committing a crime, of course, to get into jail to visit his friend, but nonetheless, so he has flaws. And the solo trumpet, you know, this lonely trumpet aspect, clearly was something that Jerry liked to work with throughout his career. You know, First Blood, you know, sort of the ultimate flawed warrior or flawed hero. But that's actually what Last Castle was. And I can't think of a better example of a flawed hero, because Robert Redford literally admits that he's a flawed character. He committed a crime to which now he's paying the price. And he just wants to be left alone to do his time. And then the ideas in the story developed that into a whole movie, which people can watch. But Jerry's, it was a perfect use of solo trumpet. Admittedly, some people do think of this score as primarily a solemn, sad elegy to a fallen warrior, because, you know, Redford is a general and all of this. But I always thought the architecture of this score is really interesting, because it's really a slow build to all the action, of which there is a fair amount of, you know, action material in the final third.
I really love the back-to-back action cues, Taking Command by Jerry, which I think was on the original album. But now you've added the Mark McKenzie action cue that's the longest cue in the score, or close to it. I guess it's not quite as long as some versions of The Flag, but it's 6.5 minutes long, Battle for the Castle. And it's almost like a case like with Joel McNeely on Air Force One, where you can tell this younger composer, Mark McKenzie, is just, you know, wanting to impress and do his best kind of Jerry Goldsmith homage, because it really fits in well with the rest of the score. But, you know, it's very intense and sustained action cue that he contributed that fits in with Jerry Goldsmith's best action music.
Thank you.
Well, of course, Mark was orchestrating for Jerry at the time, so it was a sort of a logical wedding of the two minds. You know, Mark, of course, was a very established orchestrator.
And also a composer by this point. He was pretty well established. I think Entrada had already been releasing some of his excellent scores at the time.
Yeah, that's actually what Mark wanted to do. That's probably not uncommon. I've talked to a few other orchestrators who also composed, of which maybe the most famous was Hugo Friedhofer, really did not want to be an orchestrator. He wanted to be a composer, which, of course, ultimately he became known for. Mark fit in that direction of he kept getting asked by, you know, major composers, you know, of the Danny Elfman and Bruce Broughton and, you know, this level, John Williams on Patriots and things where he was brought in to orchestrate because he's gifted at it. But he really wanted to get away from being dependent on those and being a composer, but generally did not get asked for do, you know, he certainly didn't do major pictures, you know, Hallmark Hall of Fame projects and things of that nature, not to put them down, but he didn't get asked to do major films. So he ended up making his career mostly orchestrating, but he did hit it off well with Jerry those last few years. So I guess it was logical that Jerry would ask him to get involved in this longer queue.
Right. And he was already orchestrating Jerry's material, so he was familiar with the thematic content and the architecture of the score. So, I mean, more appropriate that he should do it rather than bringing in some other composer if he can, you know, spare the time around the orchestrating.
You know, I can't swear to this if my memory recalls, because it goes back a few years, but I do recall the discussion on this lengthy battle cue had more to do with its rhythmic vitality than it did any melodic quotations. So it was really more Jerry needed Mark to hold together 6.5 minutes of action without it being variations on his main theme, but more using the rhythmic pulse and aggressive energy of the action cues Jerry had already established, because he's already got like Let's Go Ladies and a couple action cues after that that established it's a syncopated rhythm, dun 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 kind of rhythm. And I think Mark tended to avoid melody and mostly did rhythmic ideas. So his battle cue fits in real well with what Jerry had already established. That's my recollection, is that's what they talked about. I think it also, though, had to do with, which maybe now isn't okay to slide into this, but more than any other project in Jerry's career, and that's a long career, they ran into that one particular issue, and that was with the controversy over the flag. Because the finale of the picture, of course, it builds, and I don't want to spoil something, but it builds to a flag raising. You see that in the artwork for the picture. But our album on the, you know, we do those flipper covers when we get permission, and we have a reproduction of the original campaign. And there's probably a lot of people that haven't seen it, but that's the flag being hung upside down. That's a major story element in the picture because, of course, the idea when you raise a flag upside down, you know, on any kind of a military base, that's a sign of distress. That's letting anybody know that the fortress or castle or base, you know, what you will, is in distress, under siege, has fallen, you know, anything of that nature. And that was a thematic idea of course, The Last Castle, you know, as in a chess game. And this, of course, was a glorified chess game between two generals moving their pieces. And they had pawns and everything on a big scale, obviously. And Jerry had talked about they had a lot of trouble because, of course, there's controversy in showing a flag upside down just in general. But as many people may now be aware, Jerry was finishing the recording sessions for the picture as 9/11 had happened. And that changed everybody's, I mean, everybody immediately said, you know, what do we do? Because it was a major picture. This was a DreamWorks film and it was, you know, Robert Redford. And all of a sudden, everybody in the country was posting American flags, you know, in their bumpers, in every building you went in, the windshields. It just, that was a time when everybody put up American flags because of what had happened. And here's a movie which is going to climax in the raising of a flag upside down. So they immediately had to rework that. I don't even know all the details. I talked to Malcolm at length about it because everybody on the scoring sessions was aware we're rescoring because the finale of the picture, there's a something isn't working.
So was the finale, the picture being recut as well, or was it just the scoring approach that needed to change?
No, they were recutting because they were, as the artwork will show, when you look at the inside of the album, that's a reproduction of the original one sheet, which shows the flag upside down. Of course, I'm not involved in the film per se, so I only know the discussions.
Well, let's talk about how it affected the music. I mean, the original soundtrack album, I believe, had a different version of the flag than was the one that was in the film, maybe because that was done at a late pickup session or something like that. But on this album, you've included, to my surprise, not only two versions, but three.
Yeah, they had two, and they're all different lengths. You know, there is a buildup to the flag raising scene, which is a very tense scene that people have not seen the movie may want to watch, because in my opinion, it's a great movie. I like, it's not an action film per se, although there's plenty of action, but it's a conflict story, obviously, about two warriors. In that entire buildup, I was definitely concerned because the direction of the scene was going to be the flag being raised upside down, the sign of distress. And cut me off if I'm giving too many spoilers, but in getting to that final confrontation after the battle that leads to the flag raising, raising it upside down, I think was the game plan until 9/11 had happened. I tried to find out more about that with Malcolm McNabb because there isn't a whole lot that we were able to find online. Jeff came here, as in Jeff Bond, came here prior to doing the liner notes so we could, you know, sort of talk about this part of it. But we both admitted, I mean, he wanted to pick my brain. The most I could say was what Jerry had talked about in brief, and Malcolm McNabb's recollection was it mostly had to do with the aspect of you can't show the flag being raised upside down when the entire mood of the country is what it was post 9/11 for literally, you know, those few weeks after it. And of course, the scoring sessions on this went right up to 9/11. Malcolm said they had to come back after Jerry titled the, he of course changed from, you know, the theme from Last Castle became, you know, the September 11, 2001. So there was clearly the proximity. Clearly there was discussions over the theme that we have at the moment for the flag raising would not work in the context of the picture. There was a much more, I don't want to say muted because it's still a climactic moment, but there's less of a huge flag waving Americana moment to it because that was not the ending that they had shot. And so when they had to change the ending of the picture to have the flag raised appropriately, which then, of course, changes a whole lot of what this picture's architecture was leading to. And I don't know enough about what went on during the movie making process, how frustrated they may have been, you know, that 9/11 happened and now the ending of their movie had to be altered. I, of course, don't know. Malcolm just mentioned that they had to come back in and record. And of course, in the flag cue, Jerry found himself trying another version, but they were still cutting it. Therefore, I guess there were timing considerations, which there always are. But in those couple of days, there were obviously discussions also about, I think, I can't say the exact date, but Jerry was going to premiere this theme from Last Castle in a concert, or there was some kind of a presentation that was already being discussed, which also put pressure on him there. Therefore, there were time elements. You know, they were really under pressure. And I think the interim flag cue was largely still drawn a bit towards the idea that we now have to change the mood from being so dramatically oppressive to more of a majorly triumphant moment, but they weren't going to be as overt about it.
I just remember when the original album came out, there were a number of people who were disappointed that the film version of the cue wasn't on the album. But now we've got it, and the album version and another alternate. You really are packing this with a lot of additional stuff because you even include on the second disc the original album, which does it maybe have some unique takes or assemblies or something like that?
It's just a remastering, but Decca supplied us with their original album master, so we were able to remaster it. And yes, there are a couple takes that Jerry, I don't know how much it was Jerry and how much it was Bruce, because Bruce worked heavily on this project a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Bruce Botnick.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry. Of course, I shouldn't name drop. That's silly. And in this case, that was also in part, and we shouldn't undersell this, to most of your, I shouldn't say your audience, because it's our audience too, of course, but most of our collective audience will look at the second disc and not find it of major interest other than, you know, the remastered version of the original album. But that's all covered, of course, in the first disc. But
for me, I find it fascinating because I knew ever since I spoke with Leonard Slatkin that Jerry was constantly honing his craft of conducting over the course of his career. And it was something that, you know, he maybe didn't start out super confident in, but he was constantly trying to improve himself. And this is towards the end of his career, as I understand it, Jerry conducting some classical standards for the film. He recorded these classical pieces himself instead of using existing recordings. So as a Goldsmith fan, to me, that's fairly fascinating.
I don't know how much I would call them standards. I mean, as such, when we think of Goldberg variations or Mozart, you know, and stuff, they're part of the classical literature. But in this case, he wasn't doing Beethoven's Ninth or something like that. They selected a relatively eclectic group of classical music because, you know, Gandolfini's character listens to classical music.
Even Salieri, which I thought is neat because Salieri's kind of overlooked thanks to the Amadeus depiction.
That was picked, I'm sure, because it had to do with the Salieri versus Mozart conflict, you know, and there is Mozart, of course, in this as well. It, you know, it's a little more subtle than it first appears, but Jerry did supervise the classical music, most of it. I know there's a concerto for oboe that we had to license, actually, from Capriccio because we wanted the same performance that's actually used in the film and the film people. You had to license it from Capriccio as well. Adding to the complications of putting this album together, because there's a lot of licensors involved, and we try to cover every one of the bases if we can, rather than, you know, leave stuff off because we couldn't get it cleared. But that's where Bruce Botnick was involved, because Bruce was the engineer on the classical music, and then, of course, Mike Lang, being a key LA musician, he was recording, I guess, the Bach pieces, and therefore, what we felt was, you know, these are all people that the Jerry Goldsmith audience is familiar with. They know who Mike Lang and Bruce Botnick, and of course, they know who Jerry Goldsmith is. So we started agreeing amongst ourselves, there's enough reason to do a second disc on this, just because Jerry is the artist. You know, he's a conductor. Yeah, he conducted these pieces, or because Bruce Botnick did engineer them, you know, this kind of thing.
I mean, if you're going to a second disc anyway, you may as well include as much as you can.
Yeah, and we talked about that because do people really need the original album remastered? And of course, no, not everybody does. But then we also felt, especially with Goldsmith, it does make sense to let people have what was Goldsmith's vision of presenting this music? What did he want people to hear in what order, how it was edited and stuff?
Especially since I think the original album had some manufacturing issues and stuff, that certain pressings weren't good. So it's good that you're redoing it, you know, Jerry's original conception of the album.
And you don't get a choice because CD1 and CD2 are attached in the same jewel case.
For me, I'm glad that people are going to have the opportunity to rediscover this score. I think a lot of people are familiar with it, but your new presentation fleshes it out a whole lot more. Even with the shorter cues, it makes the development of the material more organic, I guess. Like you said, it's a slow burn score, but I feel like the buildup is more affecting with the complete score than with the abbreviated presentation. So thanks for bringing it into the world. One of the last Jerry Goldsmith scores from the 90s onward that Verez doesn't control. So I'm glad you brought it out for us.
Well, then I mentioned to you, it's one of my favorite of his latter career simply because it's pure military and it's full of trumpet solo. But I also thought the architecture of the score is very skillful. It's just a haunting score that then opens up into some spectacular action and it ends very, very movingly.
I agree. Excellent. Well, thanks for joining me. And until the next time you put out a Jerry Goldsmith score.
Well, there's more coming. Thank you.
Now, I want to try and get you back for our last conversation when you stumped me with a trivia question. I'm going to try and stump you, okay?
I got to leave now. This was a very enjoyable, no stumping allowed.
Now, I just was wondering, do you know what Jerry Goldsmith's very first time scoring a prison uprising story was?
Prison uprising? I don't know. I'm sure you're going to mention it's some episode of, you know, CBS Playhouse 90 or something dating back then.
Yeah, that's a good guess.
The first prison escape I know he scored that I would have thought of, but I'm thinking pictures.
Lonely or the Brave?
Well, actually, Black Patch, because...
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, yeah.
Aha, I stumped you.
That was a jail, not a prison.
Well, actually, it wasn't a prison technically in Lonely or the Brave either, because New Mexico, I don't know if they have a state pen.
It was a penitentiary.
Was he in a state pen at that time?
Yeah.
I guess he was.
Yeah, they had a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a little bit more of a kind of a small townish type of state pen. But yeah, correct.
Anyhow, that was a good guess. It is a 1956 episode of CBS Suspense, a radio show. That's why I didn't say film, but it's called Eyewitness. And it's like there's this reporter that does an eyewitness account of a prison uprising. So he's kind of returning to a genre in some ways that he had at the very beginning of his career, even though that's a pretty different score and story.
What word do you want to use? Pandemonium, chaos, anarchy? They all fit. While the screaming guard is beaten into unconsciousness, the roaring men break apart the wooden furniture, dump the cots over the balconies, rip open the mattresses, and build a fire in the middle of the cell block. And at last, after the guard has been dumped into the yard and carried away, their anger subsides into sullen silence.